Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Snowball, the cockatoo, went viral on YouTube with his dancing. If you take this capacity for granted, don't. Humans are unique in the way our brains unpack and use complex sound for communication. Snowball also has a unique ability with sound and music, but his is distinct from ours. What biological advantage do these capacities provide us with? How much do other animals share our sensitivity and use of sound? Today we look neurologically at our brains and those of other creatures in our world and ponder what language and music adds to our human community. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. A recent article in Science reviews work in behavioral epigenetics. Epigenetics is the science of how genes are turned off and on. A good deal of attention has been paid to epigenetics in explaining the risks of chronic illness based on the mischief done by environmental stressors such as toxic exposures, malnutrition, and early childhood and prenatal trauma. Behavioral epigenetics hopes to explain these connections. This work began about 15 years ago with the study of how the nurturing behavior of mother rats affected their pups and how well those pups, once grown to adulthood, were able to cope with stressful situations. Pups that were nurtured well coped much better than pups who were not. The research also revealed that females who were not well nurtured turned out to be mothers who were not good nurturers themselves. In both cases, epigenetic processes were associated with these outcomes. Currently, research is looking into a wide range of behavior effects, including addiction and health disparities associated with injustice. According to this line of research, there are three epigenetic mechanisms: methylation of DNA that suppresses gene expression, histone methylation that also suppresses gene expression, and histone acetylation that promotes gene expression. You'll recall that gene expression just means the work that a stretch of DNA does. Methylation means attachment to a specific part of the DNA molecule by a methyl group, which consists of a carbon atom and three hydrogen atoms. Methylation also means methyl group attachment to a histone, which is a protein that packages DNA and controls whether it's open for business or not. Acetylation means attachment to a histone protein by an acetyl group, which consists of a methyl group and a carbon and oxygen atom. Methylation of DNA in a histone prevents a gene from doing its work, while acetylation of a histone promotes a gene doing its work. For example, the rats that were not well nurtured had more methylation of DNA in regions responsible for creating stress hormone receptors. With fewer receptors, hormones created during a stressful experience remained in circulation. As a consequence, the rats reacted more strongly, and the epigenetic effect was passed on from mother to daughter so that females who weren't well nurtured did not do well in nurturing their own pups. Where is this research headed? Drugs. Biotech and drug companies are very interested, just as they were in the Human Genome Project. The objective is to develop chemicals that can block or promote methylation and acetylation and consequently reverse the effects of early life trauma, social injustice, malnutrition, and addiction, to name a few. What happened to nutrients that block and promote epigenetic changes? After all, there are sophisticated biochemical pathways of considerable complexity that respond epigenetically to environmental exposures. There are also complex biochemical pathways from the epigenetic effect of methylation and acetylation to an individual's actual ability to cope with stressful situations. And what happened to changing the environmental exposures that lead to an epigenetic response? Isn't the obvious answer to prevent early life trauma, social injustice, malnutrition, and the sources of addiction? Isn't the obvious answer to use our social intelligence in conjunction with our already well-developed biochemical pathways to avert these outcomes? Doesn't this make more sense than relying on the demonstrably false assumption that drug interventions are effective in all cases without side effects? Doesn't it make more sense to assume that social and nutrient support are a more effective method because they use our already existing and quite robust biochemistry? But that's not the way science is done, and it's not how science is reported to us. 20 years ago, anthropologist Louis Liebenberg wrote a nice little book titled The Art of Tracking, The Origin of Science. In it, he argued that hunter-gatherers used the same skills and processes as scientists do today. What differs between them is acculturation and context. I think this is inspired, but I think it's more a prescription about how science ought to be done than a description of how science is actually done. Too often, science consists of hypothesis testing done in piecemeal and out of context. It's a mode of thought that's developed over the last 500 years, about 20 generations. Hunter-gatherer tracking, what our biology adapted to over tens of thousands of generations, is hypothesis testing from the perspective of the ecological whole and done very much in the context of a way of life. The epigenetics of behavior is a very small part of the picture we need to understand in order to alleviate the suffering that has drawn the researchers' interest. It's like discovering how bullets kill people. That's good to know, but it doesn't prevent anyone from getting shot. The weakness here is not in these researchers' work or their motivation in pursuing it. The weakness is in the context we as a culture have created for them. What we need to demand is science that alleviates suffering in the context of our natural history and way of life. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's topic, which is music and the brain. We have two guests with us today. Dr. Aniru D. Patel is the Esther J. Burnham Senior Fellow in Theoretical Neurobiology at the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego, California. And Dr. Patel's work focuses on music and the brain. He's the author of Music, Language, and the Brain. A primary area of interest is the relationship between music and language and how the comparative study of these uniquely human abilities can shed light on their underlying cognitive and neural mechanisms. Another research area concerns rhythm and the processes by which humans extract rhythmic information from auditory signals. So welcome to you, Dr. Patel.
Hi.
John Iverson also joins us. He studies brain mechanisms of rhythm perception and production in language and music, combining a background in physics and neuroscience and a lifelong interest in playing the drums. After undergraduate studies at Harvard, John received graduate degrees in philosophy of science and in neuroscience at Cambridge and MIT. He's now an associate fellow in theoretical neurobiology at the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego. And I guess I should call you Dr. Iverson, am I right?
Almost, Dr. Iverson.
Oh, thank you for
the invitation.
Yes, Iverson. Although it's spelled I-V-E-R-S-E-N, it's pronounced with, yes, got it. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, for both of you, is it just me, or is there a philosophical question knocking around in this research?
A philosophical question?
Well, like, for instance, what advantages, if any, do our unique capacities for language and music give us evolutionarily?
Oh, well, yes, the evolutionary question is a big one, actually, and it's one of the questions that's being debated in the field right now, whether our brains have been shaped over time to give us the capacity for language and the capacity for music. And what advantage did those capacities have for us, if any, in our evolutionary history? I don't think there's a consensus yet. I think there's people on both sides. There's a lot of people think that something about our brain did change over time to make support language. There's perhaps more debate over whether our brain changed specifically to support music, or whether music is something we may have actually invented as a kind of cultural product.
So is it the case that animals do not drum on things and bang on things ritualistically?
Well, I think John could speak to this too. I mean, there are animals that actually drum for communicative purposes. There are little kangaroo rats that drum with their feet as part of alarm signals. There's actually palm cockatoos. It's a kind of parrot where the male will find a piece of a branch or twig and hold it very carefully and drum on kind of hollow logs as a way of attracting females. So we do see some drumming, and there are apes that actually drum on tree buttresses and so forth in the wild, but these typically are seen as part of displays that maybe we wouldn't think of as musical in the same sense that we think of music when we think of drumming.
John, wouldn't you say that some of our music and drumming is also to attract the opposite sex?
Well, it certainly seems to work that way sometimes. You know, I think it's important to always keep in mind that what music may or may not have actually evolved for may not be how we're using it today, in the sense that it's, you know, not necessarily able to draw, you know, connections back in time. But certainly, yeah, certainly rock stars seem to be very good at attracting, you know, the attention of legions of fans. So there's something very deep about music and its ability to kind of bring people together.
Yeah, it's a unifier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, very much. It just inspires this kind of like, you know, worship almost.
John, forgive me, but your handset, the phone that you're on, has one of those really breathy receivers. So
uh-huh.
We're going to need you to kind of move it a little away from your mouth because you're sort of popping your P's and your S's are snapping. So if you can just hold it slightly off your face and then
sure.
speak loudly enough so we can hear you. Thank you so much. So what are the similarities and differences, either of you or both of you, between language and music?
Yeah, that's one of our main areas of interest. Well, one area we've been looking at a lot is the processing of what you might call grammar or syntax in the two domains. So one of the striking things about music is all over the world, and this is not just Western music, but virtually all forms of music involve some discrete set of elements, like notes of a scale, and some principles for combining them. You know, there are very few musical cultures where you make music by just taking the notes of the scale and kind of chucking them together randomly. There's almost always some principles or implicit principles by which music is constructed. And listeners kind of learn those principles by just listening to the music of their culture, and they can hear when notes are out of tune or that something surprising happens structurally in a sequence, and that's a lot of what gives music its feel of tension and resolution. And we're interested in the extent to which maybe we use some of the same brain mechanisms for processing that abstract aspect of music as we use for processing the structure of language, of spoken language. And we found that there's a surprising degree of overlap relative to what people used to think.
Dr. Patel, any comment there?
That was me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, God, you know, it's hard to...
yeah, hard to tell.
You guys have been working together too long.
yeah, and we're also looking at the same question at kind of a lower perceptual level. You know, interested in perception of rhythm and the extent to which rhythm perception in language and music might use some of the same mechanisms. And perhaps even more interestingly, whether the rhythms you learn of your language actually affect the rhythm... how you perceive rhythms in music as well.
Yeah, John, maybe you should tell her about your study with the Japanese versus American listeners.
Yeah, so that's the study that I'm referring to. Basically, there's a very simple kind of rhythmic perception called grouping. When we hear successive notes, we tend to group them up into chunks. And as Anu was mentioning, this is something we do in language too. We use grouping of different syllables that come along, and we group them into words. So this is what really allows us to make sense of a stream of continuous sounds that's reaching our ears and our brain. One way is to do this kind of initial step of grouping. So we think of it as a very kind of fundamental operation in perceiving rhythms. Allows us to hear, you know, words, for example, or musical phrases. So for a long time it's been thought that this is a very, you know, hardwired aspect of the way we process rhythms. The study we did, we actually... took question with that and studied people of different cultures in their basic rhythm perception of grouping. And we found that, in fact, Japanese speakers perceived this rhythm in a very different way than English speakers did. And our idea there is that it's actually the rhythm of the different languages that, in a sense, trains the auditory system what kind of rhythms tend to be more meaningful units of the language, and that then gets kind of imposed on how we hear non-linguistic rhythms as well.
Yeah, just to clarify what John is saying, this is a study where we played Japanese and Western listeners really simple tone sequences. These aren't syllables, these aren't words, these are just little patterns of tones, about as simple as you can imagine. For example, alternating short, long, short, long, short, long tones, all at the same pitch. And, well, John, you can tell her what you found.
Yeah, and just to go back, I mean, this grouping, there's something called a tick-tock effect, that if you listen to beeps, identical beeps, even just going one after another, we tend to start hearing them in pairs, like tick-tock, tick-tock. So even if you're listening to, say, a digital watch that's making the same sound with every tick, we tend to hear it as, tick-tock. And that's an example of grouping. So we like to form these binary groupings, pairs of events. So as Ani mentioned, what we did was we had these streams of tones that were varying in duration. And the typical English-speaking listener will group those as short-long. So ta-ta is the basic, unit of that long string of short-long, short-long, short-long. And that had been thought to be sort of a hardwired property of how we hear rhythms. And the Japanese listeners, a lot of them actually heard the opposite. They tended to group long-short as a basic unit, sort of basic perceptual unit. That's really surprising because that's an answer that you never get from English speakers. So the question was why, and we think in the case of English, there's actually a lot of meaningful short-long rhythms in the English language. When you have, short phrases like the cat or the house, those have very short-long sort of rhythm to them. So if you kind of put yourself back into the shoes of an infant trying to learn a language, well, they're getting just this stream of syllables, and they don't know when they're born where the words begin and end. So our idea is that, well, as they learn that, the cat is kind of a meaningful unit in language, that you often have this the followed by something else, and that the tends to be shorter than the something else that follows it. So, hey, if I start to listen for little short-long rhythms in language, those might be quite likely to be words, or meaningful phrases. And then that becomes kind of an underlying bias in the perceptual system to listen for short-long.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we're on the phone with Dr. Anirudh D. Patel and his colleague, Dr. John Everson. And we're talking about music, language, and the brain, which is the title of a book by Dr. Patel. So one of the things that I'm understanding here is that the human brain really likes to find order and patterns in things. So we do that when we're listening to sound as well. Is that part of why we make music?
Yeah, I think music, one of the reasons it appeals to us is it is a source of wonderfully compelling patterns. You have symmetry and repetition, you have variation, theme and variation, and certainly I think part of what we listen for in language is structure, and music seems to be also playing on that. But we don't want to overplay the similarities. There are also very big differences between the two.
Okay.
And I think one that we've looked at is the use of a beat as an organizing principle, the kind of a regular repeating pulse that you kind of makes you want to move. That's something that is very present in the music of most cultures and virtually absent in ordinary language. And so a lot of our research has been focused on understanding what is that? What's going on in the brain when somebody feels a beat, and why does it make us want to move? And are we the only species that has that kind of response to rhythms?
Well, before we start talking about Snowball, who can hear the beat, the two things occur to me. One is that hearing the beat is also a way that we learn. I mean, we go to school and we go A, B, C, D, and I actually had an English teacher who, God love her, taught us the prepositions. Now, I can recite them, not all the way, you know, board, about, above, across, after, against, along, amid, amidst, along, along, down, 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 forward, before, behind, below, beneath, you know, and partly because it was rhythmic. So that's a learning technique.
Yeah.
It speaks to how we use our brains.
Yep.
How early do children, I mean, is it first we're ba, 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 right?
The babbling.
And then so that happens pretty fast. How early does music start getting in?
Into our consciousness.
And
well, in some respects, it gets in before anything else. I mean, they've shown that babies can hear in the third trimester, so before they're even born.
So they like music, yeah.
And they've shown that babies will recognize songs at birth that they had heard while in utero. And
so play Mahler, right?
Yeah. Or whatever you want them to learn and like, because they're getting it. And so the mom's voice, they obviously hear that, and they orient towards that right at birth, but also familiar tunes that have been played in the environment. And so in some sense, I think music is getting in before language, because what's the sounds inside the womb are pretty loud, and then probably a lot of speech is heard as rather muffled, but the melodies and rhythms probably get through better for both music and the melodies and rhythms of the native language, actually.
So while babies might not understand, you know, they might not have a big vocabulary when they're born, they do recognize the rhythm of their native language. That's been shown that, you know, from the moment they're born, essentially, they can distinguish the rhythm of their mother tongue from rhythm of, you know, different languages.
Yeah, even if those if it's spoken by a different speaker. So, in other words, they can recognize the rhythm of their mother tongue even if it's not spoken by their mother.
Well,
if it's spoken by another person.
That's fascinating, because it means that children are learning language inside their mommy's tummy.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How nice.
Yeah.
So I want you to talk about Snowball, because he's really a kick in the pants. I love birds. I love everything, but the bird is a really... Tell us about Snowball.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah.
Well, Snowball is a sulfur-crested cockatoo. Obviously, you've seen the video. I'm not sure if all your listeners have. If they're, you know, an internet connection right now, just go to Google, or YouTube, and type in Snowball Dancing, and you'll find this video, which is actually how we were introduced to Snowball. It's a video of this beautiful white bird bobbing up and down to a tune by the Backstreet Boys. And, you know, we had some colleagues that said, you have to see this, because... you know, we'd basically been talking about rhythm and humans, and as far as we knew, it seemed like humans were the only species that could really do this quite specialized behavior of hearing a beat in music and then moving to it. And so I only mentioned a bit about that before, but it's important to distinguish that from just rhythmic movement. Most animals and even insects can move rhythmically, right? Walking is a rhythmic movement, swimming or flying. What we can do, and what this bird we have shown can do, is actually to hear, you know, fairly complex sound like music, and then extract a simpler beat out of that, and then be able to connect that beat to movement. So essentially, it's a long-winded way of saying that we can dance to music, or bob our head, or tap along, or clap along. But there are a lot of, you know, fairly complicated steps in that process. So that's why it was very exciting to find this bird that appeared to be doing the same thing that we can do. He was, you know, bobbing up and down in time to the music.
So my understanding is that Snowball and other birds have sensitivity to sound and rhythm and music and all of that, but that their brains are organized differently, that they think of it in a different way. Can you tell us what you know, either Dr. Everson or Dr. Patel?
Do you want to take that, Ani?
The idea that they're doing this kind of behavior.
But it's different?
But it's a different brain. They obviously have very different brains. And that's part of what makes this discovery interesting, I think, is that here's a little parrot brain doing something that, as far as we know, even chimpanzees can't do. You know, and their brains are a lot more similar to ours in absolute size and in structure and so forth. So that raises the question of, you know, what is it about a parrot brain and a human brain that is similar? And our hypothesis is that we share something with parrots that we don't even share with chimps. That's the ability to imitate sound.
It's very simple. Seems very obvious to most people. That's how you learn a language, is by imitating the words you hear. But this ability is actually very rare. Other primates, like chimps, don't seem to imitate sounds. They have an innate set of sounds that they can make. But parrots have this ability, and that ability seems to rewire the brain. When an animal acquires that ability, it seems to rewire the brain in ways that connect the hearing centers and the movement centers of the brain as part of this ability to pick up sounds and imitate them. And we think that's what lays the foundation for moving to a beat of music.
But how do you know that a bird brain processes sound different? I mean, is it poly processes different? Polly wants a cracker, and by the way, I process sound differently. Did they tell you?
Yeah,
how do you know?
You have to rely on neurobiology research. So there's actually been a lot of research on the neurobiology of bird communication and how bird brains produce bird song. It's a whole field in itself, actually. Mm. And they've shown that there are a number of specialized structures involved in producing songs and perceiving songs, and they've shown that birds that do learn to imitate songs have different kinds of connections between the hearing and motor centers of their brains than birds that don't. So we're relying a bit on our colleagues that study birds to tell us about how the bird brains are doing it. And obviously there are big differences in bird brains and human brains. For example, birds, even though parrots can imitate polywanacracker and so forth, we don't think of them as having full-blown language in the same sense that we do, with abstract concepts and so forth, symbolic language. But at the level of just imitating sound, they seem to do it, something that we do, and maybe even do it in a somewhat similar way in terms of the brain circuits involved.
Well, okay, how about whales?
Well, whales are interesting. So some whales do sing and learn vocally, like the humpback whale, and dolphins do and so forth. So if our hypothesis is correct, we actually should be able to see that whales can actually synchronized to a beat, and we're actually trying to pursue that right now, not with humpback whales, unfortunately. That's kind of down the road. We're working with dolphins with a colleague in Germany to see if they can learn to synchronize to the beat.
Yeah, if you imagine a humpback beat would be pretty slow.
Slow beat.
Yeah.
Well, also, you don't want them stomping anything.
Right.
No stomping, please. Although we stomp them all the time. I'm trying to, I have a bunch of questions that have long answers, but I'm going to introduce a topic, and then we'll just have to slop over after we take a brief musical break.
Okay.
Music, how about that? So here's another philosophical question that I have that I'm having trouble with reading your book, because I sense that the conclusions that you, Dr. Patel, come to in the book is that human beings like to organize their environment and create things and be technological and manipulate and create, and this is like our creative ability, and we do the da da. And I have a different sense of why we have language and music.
Oh.
But, well, I'm not a specialist in this field. I'm just a scientist, but I think that, and I think Dr. Fawcett and I sort of agree that music is a unifier, and that language is what keeps community going, what makes human beings social animals, and that there are other social animals. And so what I was going to say as a topic to bring up is, ants, very, very successful creatures. I mean, they manage their environment. They do all kinds of astonishing things. There's as much weight in ants as there are humans on the planet. God save us. And they manage without musical and language abilities. So what does this mean in terms of, we have this very complex set of abilities in terms of survival. How does this help us in terms of survival?
You mean because there are animals that can get along perfectly well
Fine.
Without it?
Yeah. They communicate different ways, but
away. Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't think language or music are necessary consequences of complex social behavior. I mean, like, as you point out, there are ants, and there are also many other examples from the animal kingdom of complex societies that don't require music or language to kind of glue the members of those societies together.
You may not know this, but Ani actually studied ants before he started studying music and brain.
Oh, no, ants are amazing. They're just amazing. I didn't realize they were all girls, too. That's really crazy.
Yeah, all the workers are females. Mm. But I think when we compare ourselves to other species, we kind of have to think, we should be thinking about primates or, in some cases, perhaps birds, if we're thinking about vocal imitation. and trying to find draw analogies between ourselves and other species. That's kind of what the Darwinian paradigm is to look for what makes us different. And so, you know, just having language music does mark us as different. So there's nothing quite analogous to that in chimpanzees, for example, that share, what, 98% of our DNA. So what happened to our brains over evolutionary time?
And why?
And why? I mean, this is just a huge topic. There's some people who think that our species acquired a generalized capacity for sort of symbolic thinking, and that then led to music and language and other complex cultural inventions. There are people who think the language itself is sort of like an organ in the brain that has its own unique genetic basis, and that music is kind of an invention that piggybacks on top of that. I mean, every possible position has been kind of articulated out there, and you know, absent a time machine, I don't think we'll ever know exactly how it got started. But increasingly, one of the things we're interested in here is, to what extent can we use the connections between music and language to actually do useful things to the brain within the course of an individual lifetime? Does learning music change the way you process language and make it even better, for example? Can you use music to improve language processing in a child that's trying to acquire language, or a person that's had brain damage and is trying to reacquire language? These are the kinds of questions you can attack empirically. You know.
We're going to do that right after a musical break. So this is Your Own Health and Fitness, Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're interviewing Dr. Aniru Patel and Dr. John Everson. We're talking about music, language, and the brain, and we're going to be right back after this break. Please stay with us. Your Own Health and Fitness, I'm Lena Berman. Stay with us.
Would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long funny ears. He kicks up at anything he hears. His back is brawny, but his brain is weak. He's just plain stupid with a stubborn streak. And by the way, if you hate to go to school, you may grow up to be a mule. Or would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a pig?
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We are on the phone with Dr. Anirud Patel and Dr. John Everson. We're discussing the topic of music, language, and the brain, which is the title of Dr. Patel's book. And we're starting to move around in this issue of comparing animals to humans. And, you know, I understand that we can also branch off and talk about the purpose that music has for us in terms of healing and health, which is part of what we, you know, show is sort of about that. But I'm still going back to, we developed this, I think, as a way to support survival.
Mm-hmm.
Language and music, I think, because they are unifiers.
Yeah, so, I mean, the question is, you know, we do a variety of things that kind of bring us together as communities. We, you know, we play sports, we support our teams, we form political groups, we have clubs. I mean, a lot of things are unifiers. The question is, which of those have an evolutionary basis in the brain? And, you know, it's very tempting to think that both language and music kind of arose through biological evolution as unifiers. And I think there are many people out there that are arguing for that position. So, you know, let me tell you about one interesting study that's kind of grown out of that line of thinking. So there's a colleague of ours named Sebastian Kirchner at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. And he's really interested in this idea of music as an evolutionary unifier that kind of solidifies bonds between people in communities. And he did a study recently where he predicted that if people participate in a musical activity, they'll be more cooperative with each other on a subsequent non-musical activity. So he studied children. I think they were about maybe 7 or 8 years old. And he had two groups. One group did kind of a musical activity, kind of a musical game, and the other group did a non-musical game. The games were supposed to be sort of equally fun, but one involved music and synchronizing kind of rhythms and voices and stuff. And then after the game, he did this kind of experiment where he left them in the room with some toys, and he rigged it so that the toys would sort of break soon after he left the room. And then the question was, what would the children do? Would they cooperate to kind of fix the toy? Would each child go off and do his own thing? And it turns out that the children that had done the musical activity were more likely to cooperate with each other in that subsequent test than children that did this other activity. And that was an interesting finding in support of the idea of music. Something about doing music together, making people feel better disposed towards one another, more likely to cooperate with each other. So, you know, it's a really interesting question. What I liked about it is it is leading to these kinds of empirical studies about cooperation. And maybe that's something we need to pay more attention to in terms of the role of music in education. Maybe it's not just about making you smarter. Maybe it's about making you a more cooperative human being.
There's a very interesting other YouTube that people might want to look at that's been discussed in various places, and people have interviewed this guy. I can't, forgive me for not remembering his name, but there's a gentleman who recorded a African-American musician, a street musician, and he was singing Stand By Me.
Uh-huh.
And he has a version of Stand By Me that's very compelling and very lovely with an acoustic guitar. And then he took that videotape and the recording and went all over the world with headphones and a little screen to show people the music, you know, the guy singing, mm-hmm. and to listen to the music so they could then tape over and add their music into it. And they went all over the world. And the video is quite chilling. It kind of makes all the hair on the back of your arm stand up on end. In one area, they were in Jamaica, and there were some people standing on the side, some gentlemen as a men, and they went over and he put the headphones on them and showed them the screen, and they were very moved. And later it turned out that this group of gangsters who were there in a sinister way, but once they saw what he was doing, they like protected him for the rest of his trip.
Yeah,
so,
well.
So indeed, I think it does,
yeah.
Because music has a universal quality to it, even though the tonalities can be very different. The types, mm-hmm. some cultures have a dissonant sound to their mm-hmm. music that's different, you know, or whatever, but it is a unifier, even generally because of the beat. So I have a naive question. I hope it's not one of those questions that's like, what is reality? But I'll try not to ask that one. But how do we know that other creatures don't have more complex ways of communicating than even ours?
John? The advantage of it.
Having an associate, yes.
Yeah, right.
You
know, I mean, we didn't know that, you know, birds could dance until someone managed to, you know, to find one and take a video of one. So there's really no way
to know. Some people knew. Some people knew. Some of us knew.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So I don't know.
Well, I have a suspicion.
Yeah.
I really do. I really do suspect this, but I mean, I'm not a scientist, so I can have these kinds. I can pop off like
yeah.
this without destroying my reputation.
Well, there's certainly a long history in biology of finding that animals can do things that we thought they couldn't do. And, you know, from tool making in chimpanzees to in crows and all kinds of clever behaviors and memory abilities. And we have a colleague here at the Neurosciences Institute that's studying octopus cognition,
oh.
you know, finding that they can do all kinds of
yes.
complicated observational learning and all sorts of stuff.
Right.
But as a note of caution, there's an equally long tradition of anthropomorphizing animals as well. So there's always a tension between these two,
yeah,
these two extremes. You know, a good point to,
yeah.
There's, you know, there's clever Hans with the horse that could add, or things that we can get fooled by too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I just really, probably along with a lot of my audience members, I feel like we really underestimate other species.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that we tend to put ourselves on top of some sort of ladder of intelligence, and I think that's probably wrong. I think we're intelligent in a different way than other species.
Or not.
Or not.
I mean, we're doing a really good job of messing up the planet right now and not communicating with each other.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, animals also can hear sounds that we can't hear. So
sure,
you
they
know.
Can they can see colors that we can't hear or can't see, for sure.
So if we take a shift and go back to the issue of music and cognition and health, I've also seen, I think, research that shows that, as you pointed to, that when people have brain damage, sometimes playing music, I mean, there's a somewhat famous singer now whose history is that she had a serious injury and retrained herself in her brain by playing music, became a musician again. Mm. I don't know if she was to begin with. You know, doctor, can I play the piano after that? Well, did you do it before? No. So probably not. But you know, that whole idea that music is actually one of the best ways to maintain cognition and to rebuild it, and for people who are aging to rebuild it and learning and all that. So do we have any idea why that is, since you guys have been delving around in people's brains?
Well, you know, certainly one of the appeals of music as kind of a tool for studying the brain is that it listening or producing music just involves nearly any brain system that you can imagine. So one way to think of it is that it's just kind of this you know, set of sounds that really engage lots of different brain processes. You can, you know, pick off a list very easily from everything from emotion to memory to, you know, hierarchical analysis and pattern analysis and all sorts of things. So, and in addition, these parallels with language make it, you know, very intriguing that the idea that you might be able to use, you know, music in some sense to rehabilitate, you know, brain damage that may have damaged the ability to use language.
There's also, you know, since a lot of our health is based on how we communicate with other people. I mean, we're comforted by other people. Other people intervene. We have, you know, one of the challenges of trying to help an animal who's sick is that you have to use sort of telepathic, empathetic ways of dealing, and which may is good, you know, it's possible. But communication and health is bound together. In addition, music is a source of comfort, and it's also very emotive. So what do you, can you springboard off of that at all? I'm looking at some of the health impacts of music and language.
Yeah, actually, so we're actually looking forward to starting a study here that sort of touches on some of those issues. We've gotten interested in research that's been done for about 20 years now by music therapists playing soothing music to babies in intensive care units in hospitals. Typically, these are preemies. And the idea here is that these babies are in some sort of quite stressful environment relative to what a normal baby would be experiencing. They're not in contact with their parents. They're often getting procedures done to them. And so they're probably activating quite a few of the body's stress responses early on in life, which is not great for the brain, in the developing brain. So anything you can do to soothe those babies early in life might potentially have a kind of a lasting benefit for them. So we're collaborating with local hospital, children's hospital, to look at what physiological effects soothing music has on babies in the NICU. And it's a project that we're just getting started with the help of a wonderful student that's come to work for us this summer from Haverford University, Jenna Cherichello. And we're hoping to start collecting data soon.
There are people who are also studying the use of sound therapy to help people with their health. And there's a number of different ways that people are doing that. I mean, they're even using, like, pitch, you know, sound, what am I, pitchforks?
Tuning forks.
And creating sounds and using bongs and things like, you know, not the kind you smoke, but the ones you hit. I'm sure the other bongs can have an effect on your health in some way or another, too. But there's a therapeutic realignment thing that goes on. Anyone who's done any singing also knows that training your voice and the breathing that goes on with that is very nurturing and healing and opens up the airways and all that.
Right.
In addition, on the other side of it, there's a lot of research about the destructive effects of noise as opposed to music.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, in your experience of studying these things, is a taste for music, do you think that it's partly this thing that happens in vitro when you're hearing music through your mom that will predispose people to like one thing or another? Because it is very individual, music, what you like, what you don't like, seems to be quite individual. I wonder how, I mean, I remember as a young, very young person not liking loud rock and roll music and never really acquired a taste for it. Now, my parents listened to classical music, so maybe that's why, but I wonder if you have any sense of that.
What causes people to like different types of music?
Yeah, what draws people to different...
That is a very good question. That's not been a major focus in our field.
John?
You're getting the clue here. I'm sure John has something to say, but I'll just finish on this quickly, which is the people that are trying to look at this are more in the social psychology realm, I think. And there's a lot of work on how music is very important in adolescence, for example, in identity formation. And the kinds of music you listen to as a teenager while you're figuring out who you are tend to kind of stick with you for your whole life and identify what kind of groups you belong to and so forth. And so I think there's a lot of complicated stuff going on in as you figure yourself out as a human being that also influence what kind of music you'd like to listen to and who you identify with and so forth.
Just to let people know, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Melina Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, who is handing me notes, making me look smart. We're interviewing Dr. Anirudh Patel and John Everson. We're talking about music, language, and the brain, which is the title of Dr. Patel's book. And I'm asking them questions they can't answer, but I'll keep trying. I'm going to ask you another question that's going to challenge you because it's not specific to your book, but it's something I'm concerned with, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to interview you both. I'm actually a little concerned about how our biology is maladapting to the communication technologies that we've developed and the possibility that we are, because they have very powerful brain effects. We're changing the way that we communicate. We're using instruments that have an effect on the brain. We're also using different learning techniques and stuff like that. Do we have any idea? I mean, have you guys looked at this at all?
Not something we've looked at. So I'm not sure what to say about that. I might turn that around, and it's kind of interesting to see, well, are we using music differently because of this? In some cases, I guess yes. Certainly, like the way that we consume music has changed a lot because of technology. But you know, ultimately, I just went to a concert last weekend, and that was a pretty, you know, I don't think that experience has really changed that much. That sort of use of music and being with a group of people listening to music, I think that's something that.
Well, it has changed because people are not. They'd still go to concerts, but there's an awful lot of very individual, very solitary things going on now. People are hooked up to their iPod, and they're walking around the streets not listening to ambient noise and not communicating with other people. People are on cell phones in not having face-to-face conversations. There's a disembodied quality to communication at this point, and there's technologies being used that have a brain effect. So...
Yeah, I wonder if your point about music as a unifier actually has to be qualified now that everybody's listening to their own iPod, you know? Maybe it's now becoming a isolator.
Well, I guess it's always had a couple of functions that may not, you know, always go together. I mean, it certainly still is a unifier. you know, there are these raves where everyone is listening to their own soundtrack, but they're still all getting together and dancing together. But on the other hand, it's also been a very powerful, like, personal, emotional modulator, as Ani mentioned. And that, you know, that may go back to the idea of playing, you know, lullabies to babies, singing to babies. That's another explanation for why music may have evolved. It's just that it's a way to, you know, modulate the emotions and emotional state of your infants. So the story goes to, you know, be able to calm them down. If there's a tiger walking by, you sing a soft, soothing song, and they stop crying.
Maybe you shouldn't do that when a tiger is walking by. And then there's another issue, which is that language is changing. I mean, OMG, LOL, BTW, I mean... Language is being tweeted, it's changing. What do you make of all of that? How do you...
Well, I think that's just always been true. I mean, as far as we know, language has always been changing. It's changing now, it's changing in every culture we know of, and, you know, I don't think that's ever been different. People coin new words and new terms. I don't think there's anything special about our historical era in that respect. Maybe music might be changing a bit faster now that there's such a easy route to disseminate music and share music among people so quickly. And that's interesting, whether or not musical styles are changing more rapidly now than they used to be in the past.
Everything's changing more rapidly.
I think, you know, another issue that has changed in terms of our relationship with music is that before, you know, we had recorded music, the only way to enjoy music was either to go listen to it or make it yourself. And that's perhaps something that, you know, is less prevalent now, the ability to just make music, or the desire to, or the, you know, opportunity to make music. There may be less of that. Seems like in our culture we've got sort of a divide between, you know, producers and consumers of music.
Yeah, that seems important, that the fact that the brain is no longer being used to make the music is important. Dr. Fawcett has something.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
I'm gonna stop passing notes.
Okay.
I wanted to go back, and actually the instigation for Ling's question about maladaptation came from me. And the kind of thing that was on my mind about maladaptation has to do with, in a way, the paradigm for this is a stress response, which has a very well-defined biological purpose.
Right.
You know, danger, get out of there, and then we have a response which enables us to recover from that extreme stressor.
Yeah.
So that's very simply put. But what we're seeing, certainly Lena and I as health educators and just literature that we read, is that human beings have created environments in which their stress response is on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the context of, so switching over to the domains that you're looking at in both language, but I'm thinking particularly even in music, but language as well, just overall communication, the question about the changing technologies creating environments to which our quote-unquote natural response is not well adapted, so that we have our health is affected in a way which is not good, because we're just not the wetware is not put together in a way to operate well in those environments that we've created.
So you mean like overstimulation, or
well, I'm thinking of, well, overstimulation is one, but that is certainly one that didn't come immediately to mind. Mm-hmm. But Lena mentioned our both attraction to and the problems we've created with noise and loudness. And we recently interviewed George Prochnik, who wrote the book In Pursuit of Silence, which is about that. Well, you can figure what that topic is about.
Oh yeah.
And also, I handed Lena the note about disembodied communication, and there are a lot of social scientists, that's what my background is in, that are concerned about not devolution, but the falling apart of that sense of community, that social fabric that falls apart when communication is not face to face. So, and communication is happening in both music and language. So, that's the summary of the question is, human beings. In fact, Dr. Patel, in the last chapter in your book, you talk about how we've taken these modes and we have done these amazing technological things with them. And so the question is, have we created technologies for communication that, in a way, our biology isn't well suited for?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
John!
Sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there are certainly aspects of that. I think, you know, ever since the internet has really become big, there's been a lot of concern about, you know, whether is it isolating people or is it bringing them together? And I guess maybe it's doing a bit of both. I think there are examples of people, you know, communicating in ways that they wouldn't have ordinarily. You know, someone who might be, you know, housebound for whatever reason or just not going out, they can form a pretty rich, interconnected world of friends, you know, not face-to-face, granted, but, So it's really hard to come up with a clear black or white answer to that question.
There is a guy that's written. Is it called In the Shallows?
It's just called The Shallows
about this issue. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Been able to. Eventually, we'll try to interview him.
But that's he's controversial, and as John said, there's a variety of there's no consensus as to what the effect is. There are those who are promoters of the technology say it's wonderful, it's the best thing, you know, since Adam and Eve, and there are others are saying it's causing disintegration. And
Well, there's also just there's the R word too. There's the increased radiation, which is causing some biological problems in the brain and the blood-brain barrier and stuff.
You know, I think it's also with any technology, it's sort of like how it's used. I mean, so I heard a lecture by a really interesting guy you might want to interview one day, actually, Daniel Smale. He's a professor at Harvard who's interested in kind of he's a historian, but he's interested in thinking about kind of neurobiology and the different cultural practices and how they affect kind of the brain states of people. For example, the amount of stress hormones that might be circulating in their blood or various other things that over longer periods that can actually affect historical modes of behavior and so forth. But one of the things he talks about is reading and how when printing and books became widespread, there was at first a real skepticism among some people saying this is kind of like a drug.
People get
these pieces of paper in front of them and they lose all contact with reality and it's ruining the morals of young women and all this sort of stuff. That's still true. So it's a technology that has transformed our world, and clearly we all deeply value books. But when they first came along, there were reasons to believe that not everything about them was good, and that's probably true.
Good.
You know, they're probably
you're right.
Anything that changes our life in a profound way can be used in ways that kind of dismember society or unify society.
Yeah, they're tools, and it depends on how the tools are used. I've always said that I'm not anti-technology. I just worry about radiation a lot because I see a lot of sick people.
Oh, sure, yeah.
That bothers me. But I think that I love my computer. My computer loves me.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, And then it's also goes back to more, I think, even deeper issues of how societies are structured and how they're maintained and how what people, I mean, I think there's an increasing movement among people who feel isolated in our modern society to build community now.
Mm-hmm.
I am so running out of time.
Oh.
I would like to ask you very briefly, just to close out, with how this research has changed each of you very, very fast, if you can, if you have an answer.
How it's changed us personally?
Yeah, whether it's changed anything about who you are. I mean, now I'm almost out of time, but go ahead.
Hmm.
No?
Well, I think lately it's made me think a lot more about how we can use the science that we're doing to improve human life. I got into this for more basic research reasons, but now I'm thinking more and more about how music affects us in the long term in our lives. That's one thing.
And John?
That's certainly one, and I guess just confirming just the importance of music in a lot of different contexts. Certainly seeing, you know, how it relates to the brain has done that.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I want to thank you both for joining me, Dr. John Everson and Dr. Aniru Patel. And his book is Music, Language, and the Brain. Again, thank you so much for this conversation.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Really interesting.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number, 707-874-2772, or you can email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org with everything spelled out. You can visit us on Facebook if you'd like. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.